what I actually said at the time was, I don't know that I'm the right person anymore.
It's been a long time since the cappuccino was fashionable.
We go to one of those cappuccino places.
Cappuccino.
Practice situational awareness next time you're at the gas station.
Yeah, so I'm talking about English breakfast tea. What is there such thing as English lunch tea?
No, we just call it tea. So right. It's for us. When I came out, I'm like, English breakfast tea? What the hell is that? And I had it and I'm like, oh, it's tea. It's what we know is simply tea. Right. It's, there is no other tea. It's the one true tea is English breakfast tea.
Well, we just love to complicate just standard things here in the U.S.
Yeah, I have a friend who's French, actually, and we took him to In-N-Out Burger. I said, would you like some French fries? And he said, I just call them fries.
It's cool. The same thing.
The same thing.
Well, you have to understand about English and the English language of England, you know, the country of Shakespeare and Milton, is we name everything by either a five-year-old or Shakespeare. There's nothing in between. That's the golden rule about British English.
Right. And so, for example,
chips.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, like when you're pushing a stroller, it's a carriage. Is that right? What do you call like a baby stroller?
Either a push chair, because it's a chair you push. Or a pram sometimes.
A pram. So there, that's a great example. Carriage. Five-year-old or Shakespeare, a push chair or a pram. Right, like no, you don't call it a stroller.
No, you got to make up a name for it, like we do.
But welcome to Dylan. You want to do the want to intro us here?
Yeah, but I was going to say it also depends on what part of England you're in because it can change drastically as well, right?
Yeah. In England, you go maybe 1 hour. The accent has changed 5 times, and bread rolls have a new name. That's basically how.
Also, when the milk enters the tea has drastically shifted, right?
Yep.
Exactly. When milk enters tea, cream or jam first on a scone as well, which, by the way, that's basically a sweet biscuit. So here's a great English to American story for me. I showed up in this country and I drove past a Popeyes. And I was like, ooh, chicken and biscuits. That sounds weird enough where it's got to be good. But I strolled in confidently and said, I'd like some chicken and biscuits, please. Fully expecting chicken on the cookie. And was so disappointed when I found out what a biscuit was.
just like a corny. Yeah. But
an English scone is very much like a sweet version of a biscuit. That's how it brings me to that story. But that's another north-south thing where does the clotted cream or the jam go on first or last?
Oh, well, so you mentioned, like you drive 1 hour and the accent's changed 5 times. The one hour takes you across the island. Is that right?
Yeah, not quite. I mean, it's a lot. I mean, if you go all the way from John O'Groats down to Land's End, which is the top of Scotland, down to the very tip of Cornwall, that's probably 15 hours.
California.
But, roughly, yeah. California, I always say California is a pretty good comparison to Great Britain, size-wise, length and breadth. Look at the map of Great Britain, I'm from that bit, the fat bit that sticks out the end, which is a guy who used to weigh 168 kilos, I guess is a bit ironic. But it's a little of a county called Essex, which is northeast of London. And really, I call it New Jersey of Great Britain. You can use your own interpretation of what that actually means. And I don't have the real accent from it moved around. But from there, driving across, you'd end up in Wales. So it's probably a good 6-7 hours east-west. So, but yeah, California is a great comparison.
So we have Phil Andrews on here, CEO of USA Weightlifting, here on Gas Station Cappuccino, episode number 125. I'm guessing this is going to be kind of where it is in the actual conversation after a little bit of that talking. But now, so everyone knows who we're talking to here. And something you just mentioned, Phil, as you talked about someone who used to weigh 168 kilos, which is, 365 pounds or so. So you lost a little bit of weight. How much weight did you lose, Phil?
So I got down to, in kilos, I got down to just about 76, and I bounced back up a little bit and then came down again. So
You lost over half your body weight.
Yes, I was half the man I used to be. That's correct.
168 is a lot of biscuits, Phil. That's tremendous.
It is. I can tell you that takes effort at that point on the biscuits consumption.
For reference, how tall are you?
About 5'6". So before anyone else makes the joke, I'll make it. I was literally around. I was a sphere.
And so what prompted you to want to make that change and lose that weight?
It was the 2011 Pan American Games, actually. So we had the Olympics coming to London in 12, and I was privileged enough to be part of Team USA's arrangements for that. And as part of that, we took a look at the 11 Pan American Games in Guadalajara. And I was figured out I can't possibly reasonably be part of the Olympic Games in 12 at this weight. So that's the real reason why I began to cut back down. But I, before that, I'd been an athlete in a few different sports. So I'd really just continued to eat as if I was still working out regularly and hadn't adapted that lifestyle. So getting back to that wasn't easy by any stretch of the imagination, but definitely did a lot for me personally.
And what was the... How did you do it, right? Like, was there one thing? I mean, obviously, like, diet and exercise seems like something, or there's other things as well. But was there, what was like your main method of that loss?
Honestly, portion control was a big part of it. Eating the right things and critically not crash dieting. So a big thing for me was I tried a couple of times to cut out things like pasta. Well, I'd rather cut off my own arm than not eat pasta. So
that's fair.
Yeah, exactly. So figuring out like immediate, a modicum of everything is okay. Like I love to eat things like sushi and tapas right through to now, because you can really easily, even in social situations, control the amount you're eating, and the variety of what you're eating is really great. Because that just helps you eat until you're full. I mean, I grew up in a culture where you clear your plate. And that's what you should do. And then as I worked for USA Weightlifting, and especially in the last few years where I wasn't doing as much for the events, then I bounced back up a little bit. And now, going from managing nutrition to really managing aggressively exercise has really been the key too. So the first time around, it was more nutrition-based than exercise-based. This time around, very much more exercise-based.
What was the biggest challenge? And how long also, what like time frame we're looking at here was like take you 2 years?
First massive loss was like 2 years. And then the second time, so I lost about 60 pounds in the pandemic roughly. Wow. That was to do with exercise, working out 6 days a week and not making excuses, not to show up at the gym. So it's challenges are, I think they're obvious. The getting started is the biggest challenge in the gym for sure. Once you make it a habit, you're good, but getting started and getting rolling. And I think the same is really true of the nutrition side too. Creating new habits was really a challenge, and getting out of that mindset of, I sit down to a, whatever it is, a 9-inch plate diameter of food and I will finish that, to, all right, well, I'm going to use a smaller plate, and you really manage those portions and manage what's on there, and eat something green once in a while, was a big step change from where I was.
I think it's crazy that you say you come from like a culture or a background that clears their plate every meal, because I think that's there's something to be said for that. Because I lost like 50 pounds, nowhere near as much as you, but like my family was always bigger, and they said like, oh, this is just how we are. And I look around and like, we're all eating the same. So maybe let's check that first and then see if your theory checks out that this is just how we are. So that's crazy. Great for you, man. That's
exactly
awesome.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
So what year did you get started with USA Weightlifting?
Very, very, very early 2013.
Mm-hmm. And originally you were in what capacity? What was your role to start?
So I actually started as a volunteer. So when I came over from England, I asked around, which NGBs need help. I got a few names, and the biggest one was weightlifting. And then became full-time with the organization as our director of events and programs in June of 2013. I'd done some work with archery and taekwondo and table tennis and judo and a few other NGBs doing different bobsled and skeleton as well.
And your wife does similar roles, right? She also works for organizations like that or 1.2?
So my wife works in high school sport fundraising.
Okay. Okay. Sorry, cut you off there. I thought she had something to do with judo, but that must have been your background.
So this is a little awkward, but I think you're thinking of my ex-wife.
There we go. Sorry about that.
Cut that.
That's right. Yes. I know. Yeah. All right.
We're still very good friends, but she actually doesn't do it.
Oh,
she
works.
She's now a mental health therapist, actually. Yeah. But it's
So you know what, Phil? Now that you say that, I absolutely remember that and know that.
Well, at one point you were right.
Yeah.
You were right at one point.
Yeah. Your facts are correct. It's just your decade, isn't it?
I'm 6 years late is what happened, or 8 years late.
Yeah. But, we're still very good friends. About that. Dude, you're totally good. We're still super good friends. And she stepped out of the Olympic movement, but she was in it for a long
time. Okay, yeah. All right. So, yes, you're working with the different sports and then ended up in weightlifting.
Yeah. So I ended up in weightlifting from January of 2013, and then officially full-time from June of 2013, running the events and the national teams program for until 2015, when we had the Worlds in Houston, and then was asked after the Worlds to become our CEO, interim first and then permanent in nothing's end.
So before you were kind of working for USA Weightlifting, or really kind of took the helm, but we're talking, let's say 2012, the males, we had how many males in the Olympics in 2012?
One, Kendrick Farris.
And how many females?
Two, Holly and Sarah.
Now, this most recent Olympics, the 2020 Olympics that happened in 2021, we had how many males?
Four men, four women, full team. Right. Both.
Full team.
Went from three to eight. And as far as success in that 2012 Olympics, how many medals did the U.S. get?
Sadly, zero.
Zero. How many medals did we win in 2020?
Two, Kate and Sarah.
Two. So, Phil, as you've been kind of at the helm of USA Weightlifting and working in some capacity, our performance on the international stage obviously had a huge increase, a huge uptick. What do you credit that to? Or furthermore, obviously everybody credits you. How did you do it?
Yeah, well, I think it's a huge team effort.
Those questions you can answer, obviously.
Right. Look, it's a huge team effort. Part of the reason I joined weightlifting was honestly had some opportunities. We had CrossFit coming in and really growing the sport. I think that is the key factor. And anybody who doesn't say thank you, CrossFit, for what they did for the sport of weightlifting really needs to look at the reality of the situation. I think the biggest thing that we did to drive success on the field of play was closing the Olympic Training Center program. Of course, that's got its own emotions attached to it. And there was a lot of benefits to that program. I'm not going to hide that. But pushing out the resources that we have, which are fairly limited in nature, to the people who made those athletes successful in the first place, the personal coaches, is huge. And the reason for that is my observation still is, you can't in this sport, there is no one coach who is the best in the country or whom is the best for every athlete in the country. That's because people are different. We are a very diverse nation. We have very diverse coaches and we have some phenomenal coaches. Let's go and empower them. And with the athletes that they helped produce and help get to that level, that decentralization, which it pits to a degree, people against each other, coaches against each other. People might be super good friends, but they want to beat each other. That's part of the nature of the American psyche and American culture.
Absolutely.
We use to do better. So I truly believe that decentralized approach was the key thing that we did. If we did other things too, but that was the number one thing we did, was empowering the local coaches, empowering athletes to be with the coach that they choose rather than feeling like they had to be at the Olympic Training Center, and pushing money out that way too so they could support themselves. Now, of course, if you're in Northern California, a stipend is not going to support you 100%. I'm not daft enough to think that. In rural Michigan, it might. But it's pushing out those funds and that support locally really was a massive difference maker. And that's where you saw, you know, people like Spencer Arnold, Danny Camargo, Dave Smits, Ray Jones, Amy Everett, you know, all of those coaches who you see now as fixtures, if you like, each World Championships, and indeed in some cases of the Olympic Games, that's the success is attached to that athlete. It's not necessarily attached to the coach, because if you coach an athlete to that level, you go. And that's the way it should be. It should be competitive. It should be about the athletes you have on hand. And it should be about utilizing what we have best. What's our best asset in this country? A volume of really good coaches who are willing to innovate to beat the guy next to them.
What I love about that as well is talking about the competition and that driving performance. I'm just finished this book by a sports psychologist, and that's actually a lot of what he discusses. Is a lot of times people think of competition as people are going to these competitions trying to beat the point of the competition is to beat the other person, right? His kind of argument is the point and the benefits of competition is it drives your best performance. That what's driving is knowing that there's somebody beside you is going to force you. You are going to run harder. You're going to run your race harder, and you are going to run faster if there's someone running next to you than if you were by yourself. And so, you're trying to beat that other person, but it's not necessarily, but really it's that other person is helping you. It's a symbiotic relationship, because if they weren't running there with you, you wouldn't be performing your best. And so kind of breaking that out of the Olympic Training Center to these different coaches and the different athletes, it drives everybody's performance, right? The coach is obviously trying to get more out of these athletes, but when you have these different coaches, it's like that's an extra person on their team. If you have one coach or one coaching staff, which is trying to drive the performance of all these different people, they're split between all these different people, and they're not going to try to drive one person to beat another person in that same group. They're trying to drive that person to be their best. But the only way to drive that person to be their best is by pitting them against somebody else, right?
Yeah. To a certain degree. Here's a great example is, it's people to say, is Ray Jones the best coach in the country? And the answer is, I don't know. What I know is Ray is a phenomenal coach of CJ Cummings. Mm-hmm. But part of the reason is Ray wakes up in the morning, and at 6:01, his alarm goes off, a piece of caffeine kilos coffee in his cup. From that moment on, he is thinking about, how do I get CJ 0.001% better? And CJ knows he's got somebody in his corner that whole time. Case in point, before the Olympic Training Center was closed, Carl Pearce and Kendrick Farris. Phenomenal coach and athlete relationship.
Absolutely.
And all Carl thought about for many years was, how do I get Kendrick Farris 0.0001% better? How do I program Kendrick Farris to peak at the right times? How do I plan competitions for Kendrick to go at the right times? And now you've got an entire organization focused on that very same way of working. So yes, we have Mike and we have Piros. Their job is not to coach day to day the athletes in the gym. It's to support the coaches and the athletes who are in the gym every day.
How did you know to focus on the coaches, and why wasn't that something that was like implemented before you came to USAW? Like, did you learn that somewhere else?
I was here before that. So I saw the Olympic Training Center versus the not Olympic Training Center. And of course, we had Muscle Drive around that same time, which I thought was a good program too. And they actually had two or three coaches. So you could already see the difference two or three coaches made over one singular coach. And by the way, let me be clear, Zygmunt Smalsez is a phenomenal coach. But, I ran a lot of camps in that. In that facility with Ziggy. And I could see that, you can't have that many eyes in that many places. And I saw athletes come and go in the Olympic Training Center. Some did phenomenally well and some did less well. And I think that points to the symptom of the problem. I'm always trying to find myself as a problem solver. And then, I heard so many times in that quad, and this is a period where we won basically nothing. And in fact, this was the period of time when I was making cases to our then CEO, we have to go to Youth Pan Ams. We have to go to Junior Pan Ams. Why? Because we need to breed a culture that we can win. I have this sort of normally well-known catchphrase, it can be done. And that's where it comes from, that we can win in America. We have the athletes, and we win in other sports where there is also prevalent, let's be honest, doping, track and field, powerlifting. We win in both sports. Cycling too a little bit, where there is prevalent doping. So we can do it in weightlifting. And I think that's where breeding that culture of winning was really important. If you then look at people who went to the Olympics, Holly Mangold, let's talk about the 12. Holly Mangold, Sarah Robles, and Kendrick Ferris. They weren't actually, in the majority of the time, in the Olympic Training Center. Kendrick very rarely visited the training center. Holly did spend some time at the training center, but was primarily coached by Mark Canella. And at that time, Sarah was primarily coached by Joe Michella. So it's out of Phoenix. So you've got three people going to the 12 games who spent at least the majority of their time with a personal coach. So that there was already a proven winner. And I heard so many times, U.S. coaching is weak. We can't, you know, U.S. coaches are terrible. All this rhetoric, which was appalling. And I remember sitting in the first coaching symposium we did and said, let me be very clear. We have the coaches in this country to be successful. And everyone started applauding. I'm like, this is not new information. We have very good coaches in this country. There are other problems we need to solve. And by the way, when those coaches get their best talent, part of the issue with having an Olympic training center is, hi, would you like to come here and have your room and board paid for, be amongst the elite, if you like, for the whole time and training? And that is super fun. It is. I mean, getting everyone in the building at the same time, I mean, it shows up for all of us when we see those trial sessions, right? Where you see all these athletes, just like right now at the Arnold, a few weeks removed now, where you saw, you know, all those really elite athletes, one after the other, on the Rogue Strength stage. It's awesome. That's every day at the Olympic Training Center. Those were the great things. But you can replicate that with camps. And it's just, you know, to your point, did I know it would work for sure? No. Was there evidence to suggest it would? Yeah. And ultimately, the OTC has proven that it, over the course of time, if you look at data, emotionally, it's a really big place and has got a lot of great memories and did legitimately contribute to a lot of Olympian successes. Shane Hamann, Cheryl Haworth, Tara Knott, Carissa Gump all say the OTC made a big difference for them in the era that it was. But now we can support people and we have some more resources to support people in the field. Statistically, our higher performing athletes generally do better when they're at home with their athletes. The other thing is, now you go to a CNK Invitational or you go to the Florida State Championships or you show up in Michigan at a state championship or a local meet and you see a Kate Nye, a Wes Kitz, yeah, a Morgan King, Harrison Morris, and so forth, and Maddie Rogers in your local meet and you've just started, that's pretty freaking cool. And that's the same thing absolutely. For the American Opens. You know, so that was the other part of it, is you now have superstars in your local meets. Whereas before, the only place you did that was when we held a meet in Colorado Springs.
Right. And that's something actually coming up around here in Northern California, is there's so many local meets, you know, once a month, twice a month, there's a meet between Sacramento and the Bay Area. And you would get guys out there because the hassle-free programs, they start the kids in high school. And so you'd have your Ian Wilson and your D'Angelo Osorio, and you'd have these types of guys who are lifting at the local meets because they're still young. Right. And they're in the area still, and they're still, you know, still in school or that type of thing. And that was definitely something that was encouraging, and same with Cal Strength being out there too. You know, a lot of those guys chose to train at Cal Strength rather than at the Olympic Training Center, even when it was there. Right. And so you'd get those guys in local meets. So you'd go to a local meet and you'd be on the same platform as these national champions. And that was something that was encouraging, you know?
Well, it's almost like, Phil, you're taking more of a professional, you know, weightlifting is a professional sport for some people, but you're taking more of a mainstream professional sport approach to it, right? Like these athletes are
pretty well.
Huh?
I said pretty well. That's a fair summary.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's almost like, you know, let's say like, you know, Stephon Curry. Yeah. He has a strength conditioning coach on the team, but he's doing all this off-season work with his team, his crew, you know, off-site, right? It's kind of like that same. And then when they come to the season, it's almost like a Demas kind of like campy
training camp,
like kind of training camp environment, right? Is that not accurate? Kind of.
I think that's fair. I mean, certainly you could look at it that way. I've talked about how the NBA and the NHL in particular deal with draft picks and prospects. Think of it that way, where you've you know, even in team sports where you have a head coach, but you've got to keep an eye on those prospects that might be as far afield as Sweden and Finland. In the case of hockey, hockey's my sport, so I go to that a lot. Mm-hmm. The thought was, how do we get the best out of what we have? But it is to a degree professionalize it. And that's where, you know, we bring the resources like sleep and sports psychology and sports nutrition to the table. But, you know, who are we? You know, Mike Gattone of Pure Steve Mass, let's be clear, are phenomenal coaches. But who are we as an organization to tell you that we know better than you about the athlete you spend 4 hours a day in a training hall with? But we can certainly advise you, help you, support you, and be that independent voice. And I think that's where the professionalism comes in, and the relationship between Mike Piros and a Dave Spitz or a Ray Jones. And those are critical relationships.
Something you said earlier, I've been thinking a lot about, which is, you mentioned how, you know, what was the tagline? Not we can do it.
It can be done,
right? So that it can be done. I think that's important in talking about, you know, youth or junior Pan Ams and having success there, right? So it's from, I think, a set too of when you see the successes happening on the international stage, you know, doesn't really matter the age group, that just kind of tells people it can be done, right? And I think that you train differently. So if your goal is to make the Olympic team and you're putting your heart and soul and everything you've got with the goal of making it to the Olympics, compared to if you are training with the mindset of actually winning a medal, right?
Yep.
Will you train differently? And absolutely, I think so, right? Yep. I think that in training, you will train differently, right? With a different fervor, if you will, or whatever you want to say, yeah. If you have the goal of stepping on the podium compared to the goal of making the Olympics. You have to really believe it. And the only way to really believe it's possible is to see some evidence of that. So when you see some evidence of Americans winning on an international stage, it doesn't matter if it's youth Pan Ams or junior Pan Ams or youth world, you are seeing an American on the top of the podium with an American flag around his shoulders. They're playing the national anthem, right? Like this type of thing. It's like, oh, look at that. An American just won at Pan Ams. So, and now those people, they say, hey, I won Pan Ams. Why can't I win the Olympics? And you train differently with the expectation of podium compared to what the hope of qualifying.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's a few things to that. Yes, we did run into a generation where we had both a Harrison Morris and a CJ Cummings at the same time. Well, let's be honest, that's rare. That's phenomenal, right?
Nice.
You know, and it's behind me. I have a poster with that, you know, that youth world record that won our first bronze medal at the Worlds. But between youth, junior, and senior worlds, we won 95 plus medals in the last quad at the world level, plus Olympics, plus the youth Olympics. That's, you know, and now you look at the US women's team. You need to go to, in order to be on the team for the 2022 Pan American Championships, you actually have to be above the average medal for that body weight category. Mm-hmm. Just to be on the team. 71 kilo, you know, it's our category, right? I did the medals. I was fortunate enough to do the medals at the Arnold. The winner of that category was an Olympic silver medalist and 2019 world champion, and still a world record holder at the junior level in that category. The silver medalist was the current reigning world champion, and the bronze medalist was the reigning junior world champion. And by the way, silver medalist, I think bronze medalist in the world championships. That was a pretty impressive podium, and that comes back to that competition point you made earlier. But that culture of winning started with the 2014 Junior Pan Chile, when every single woman won a medal. And Katie Winters was on that team, Tori Galuli was on that team, Jenny Arthur was on that team, Marissa Klingseis was on that team on the men's side. I remember D'Angelo was on that team, the Barnes brothers was on that team. Might have been 13, but that's where we started, and then it started rolling. And now, if you're an American, especially an American woman, and you go into an international meet, there's an expectation that you're going to be competing for medals, going to be in the A group. It's not even a question anymore. If you're a woman in this country,
trying to make that team, it's trying to get on the podium.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's the end goal now. It's changed. It used to be, I had one athlete who, you know, I asked for a lot of feedback around that time that we're making decisions about decentralization and what have you. And the USOPC, let's be clear, they wanted to close the program too. So it wasn't just us talking about it. But one of the pieces of feedback I got from that was, look, we battle each other to make the team and then we kind of don't care about the results. And that's now changed. Now it's about, I'm going to get on that team, but my end goal is here, to your point, Danny. And similarly, the end goal is no longer making it to the OTC too. That would used to be, that's where I can get to. It's realistic now.
Yeah.
Now you're American. We are legitimately, and it is especially for women true, one of the very top weightlifting teams in the world. And so the expectation doesn't finish at where you finish at nationals. Or where you, what you make at nationals, the expectation.
So funny. It's so wild just seeing that change in real time.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Like, you know, since 2013, even like kind of when
Phil got on board.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's been so crazy and been so, you know, amazing to watch.
And
you,
now, one thing, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. And you mentioned women's weightlifting in particular. I think right now USAW has more than 50% are women that have memberships. Yeah. Is that correct?
That's
yeah.
Correct.
So, like
athletes, yes.
Our athletes. Yeah. So right now, like it's a woman dominated sport a little bit when it comes to competing on a national stage. So where do you see women's weightlifting in particular within 5 to 10 years? Cause it's growing rapidly.
I'm going to be excited to watch it. I mean, you just look at the people coming through as well as the existing names and, you know, Ali Tolman, Shayla Moore, Katie Estep, Miranda Olray, Megan Stray, Avery Owens, and of course, Mary Deason Lapham. You know, those new names making it onto the roster or just off, it's huge to see them come through. And we have a pretty young roster as it is. Like Jordan Dela Cruz is not old. Maddie Rogers feels like she's been around for an eternity. She's actually not old at all. Mm-hmm. So it's, but she's sort of the grizzled veteran, in, by the way, a lot of people perceive. You know, Kate Nye is, you know, Olympic silver medalist, but born in 1999. She's very young too. So I'm excited to watch it. That's before you talk about Haley Reichardt, you talk about Anna McKeldry, you talk about Avery Owens coming through from the junior ranks, you talk about Katie Estep, who just set a youth world record. There's a lot of talent there, and it's only going to get more. You know, it's the tough thing for women's weightlifting now is that you no longer have what I call the Morgan King phenomenon. Morgan came into the 2013 nationals and won Hunter. Right, exactly. At a skating rink. And won by a margin with a 157 total. 157 in the 49 kilo, I grant you, it's gone up a kilo, would not even get you close to the podium. I mean, you're talking in a category now where in America you've got CeCe Carr for a start, totally more than that in the category below. You've got Morgan herself, who was, you know, recently retired, but she was doing 185 till the day she retired. You've got Haley Reichardt, Madison Pinnell, Jordan Dela Cruz, all up there doing 185 to 200 kilos. That is right there a picture of, we were talking about 71s earlier, the 49s are just as deep. And that's, you don't have that phenomenon where somebody's coming in at 157 and they're able to grow like Morgan did whilst being on the national team and on stipend. And I've never really sat down and talked to Morgan about this, but, you know, I wonder, are there athletes there that could be Morgan Kings? That because they don't come in that same way, because it's impossible in Team USA now to do that, don't quite get the same support, progress, or encouragement perhaps that they might if they were Morgan King's era. And that's taking zero away from Morgan. Morgan's a phenomenal athlete. She's an Olympian. You know, she's the Morgan King. But, you know, is that Morgan King phenomena of coming in just dominating a category and being growing with that category, is that still possible in a competitive? So that's probably one evolution that's got to be made, is how is that athlete that comes in like Morgan at 157, which these days will be bottom of the A group, maybe B group of the nationals, how do they get the encouragement to become what Morgan King did? And the second piece of it, I think, is how does how does that momentum continue and how does it bleed over into the men's side? Because let's be honest, that's becoming the issue. It's becoming, the women are great. How do we make sure we have enough men coming into the system so that we can replace a D'Angelo or a Donovan Ford or a Kane Wilkes or a CJ or a Harrison?
It seems like the old names, you know?
Yeah.
So, well, that's it. You know, I mean, we've had one or two come through, but it's less common in the men's side. Wes Pitt's exception for, you know, he came in, but even he was 2014.
Yeah, I was going to say, even that's now is almost like, he's kind of, like you said, he's that veteran presence already.
Yeah.
Being young in the sport. But like you said, there's the women are just so stacked. There's just so many good women. And it's
so good.
And it's so great. And I think like you kind of were saying earlier, it's just like, is killing those stigmatisms with like strength sports through CrossFit, right? Has really opened up strength sports to women and men. But like, I feel like even more for women, like, oh, like you're back to your, we can do this kind of thing. It's that same kind of mindset. And it just really just like blew up.
This in 2024. In 2024, likely max team size will be 3. So if you think about it, we're now staying in the same position as the United States that we are in swimming or track. Your biggest challenge is making the United States Olympic team. It ain't meddling. It's making the team again, because we're now at a point where you're going to have to be good enough to win a medal in order just to go to the Olympic Games.
So cool. So cool.
Something you mentioned a few times, one time you mentioned it with that decentralization, if you want to call it, or another time just supporting these athletes is stipends. A few things on that. One is, I'm just going to ask them, kind of get through both of them because the answers might be intertwined. One is, how are those stipend amounts determined? And then also, you know, we heard that this year those stipends were reduced by 30%. So is that true? Were these stipend overall stipend amounts reduced? And then also, how did you determine what those amounts are, like, by the athletes?
So going quad to quad, we actually increased our athlete stipends by over 900%.
Right, of total money going out.
Total money. And total money has actually continued to grow every single year. One of our challenges is I believe, in fundamentally making it so that there's a policy. So you know what you've got to go and do to get on a stipend. So as we, back in 2019, so we moved to the 2020 to 2024 quad. Before the pandemic, we published what we were going to do, which focused it a little bit more. And yes, some of the amounts to each athlete went down, but the amount of athletes actually increased slightly. So, you know, we, for example, we average about $54,000 going to athletes every single month. And that is, descending hierarchy. So if you're in the top four in the world, you're going to get the maximum amount of money. The issue in some ways is, and this is fair and not fair simultaneously, those are also the people who are likely to get money from other sources too. So then you have our silver level, which is, sorry, the gold level, which is I'm likely to qualify for the Olympics. Silver, which is I've got a good chance to qualify for the Olympics. And bronze is really about junior development. So we did take out one or two ways of making it through the bronze level. But, you know, as I say, we're, in terms of actual money out the front door, it's actually increasing, not decreasing. So 30% down is true in some of the individual amounts, but the physical amount going to athletes has increased every single year. And that's tough to maintain, by the way.
Absolutely.
Do you have people who don't make the Olympics who are getting more stipends than people who do make the Olympics? And how does that work? Like, no, is that the goal, the Olympics?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. No. Okay.
Because the only way that in theory could happen is if somebody, first of all, there's clauses in that say if you make the Olympic Games, you will be on this stipend level. But there are ways that you can qualify to a gold level, for example, through setting a youth world record. So it's possible that you could be on a silver. So you can't be in the top eight in the world and be making less than somebody who's not going to the Olympics. But it's possible for someone like a KDS Step or a Hampton Morris, who've just set a world record, to be on gold. And then you to have some sort of shot still at the Olympics and be on silver, to be sitting eighth or ninth or tenth. So that happens a little bit more in the men's side, where there's people who might be with a chance of making that top in the last quad. pop in the continent. In the women's side, that's not possible.
Is it like only so many people per level? So like say someone does something that would qualify you for a higher stipend. Does that mean that somebody at that stipend gets bumped out?
That happens per body weight category. So there's maximum 2 per body weight category you can be on the stipend, unless you're within 4 kilos of the third person. So that's that rule really exists for the current situation in the 71 and 49s, where you've got more than 2 who are really close with each other.
Yeah.
But that could mean you have a really good athlete who is third or fourth in that category, who's still doing a really quite elite total and making some teams. But we already have people above them who are doing better.
That's got to be hard to manage, because on any given day, either of those athletes could beat each other, you know?
Yeah, it is.
Right? That's got to be kind of tough. It's a general statement, I guess, not really a question, but.
It really is. But I mean, if you look at the 49s, which you've read it, that really showed up last year, it was effective because it meant that that third athlete did have to stay within 4 kilos.
Yeah.
So, you know, last quad, we had Morgan, we had Jordan, we had Haley. Right at the end, we had Madison, and we had Alyssa. So, that's tough to keep people within 4 kilos, but everyone was within 4 kilos, so everyone got a stipend.
Yeah. So, we got a breaking news, right? Which is that Phil, also, as of today, it's announced today, I believe, right? Was it announced at, right. Was it at 9:08? What time was that announced today?
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock this morning, just a couple hours ago, it was announced that, Phil, you are moving on from USA Weightlifting.
Indeed.
So a few things. Are you going to be completely out of weightlifting, or is there some possibility of involvement at the IWF level as you were involved with the international weightlifting for a little bit? I know you did mention that you, maybe don't know exactly what you're moving on to, but just kind of what's the deal there? Why the change? And do you plan on having a wholesale change or possibly being involved in weightlifting in some capacity?
I think it's about, it's been 10 years here nearly, just a shade short. As we go into what becomes a lot of Olympic qualifying, it's time to hand the baton off to somebody else. You mentioned, am I still going to be involved? To the extent where it's appropriate, yes. So, this sport's become a part of me. I will absolutely be back in a volunteer capacity within USA Weightlifting. I want to make sure whoever replaces me has the time to put their own stamp on it. But whenever they're comfortable, whoever that might become, I will absolutely be back officiating, loading a bar, helping out where it needs be. The sport's become part of me. I might not be from it, but it's definitely become a big part of my life and how I've grown. And honestly, I come from a different country and dived headfirst into this. It wouldn't be too strong to say it's been my family for the last 10 years, better or worse. And I will remain involved in that capacity. I'm not going to be remaining involved in too much in a formal manner in terms of the IWF. I am going to be a candidate for the Governance Commission of the IWF at the upcoming elections, but I won't necessarily be involved on a full-time basis in weightlifting. And before anybody says it, I've had to call this a couple of times, I'm not going to British weightlifting.
Yeah.
No, that's a fair question. I think people would probably wonder.
Yeah, and honestly, it's one of those where it's, well, okay, let's have a conversation about it. But it's not likely for me to go to British weightlifting. I might end up in Britain. I might end up somewhere else here in the US. Look, it's the way I want to look at this is it's been a tremendous positive 10 years overall, I think, for both myself and the organization.
Absolutely.
We just spent 45 minutes. But thank you so much. Yeah. Talking about the success of our US Absolutely. Women, especially. And that's a cornerstone. We talked about the American Open Series very briefly. I think that's been one of the other greatest things that we've done. And, I hope that the organization and the community can really grow in the next 2 to 6 years as we look ahead to what I hope to be Los Angeles 28.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. So, since it was like our best showing in weightlifting history or at least the last 50 years.
Is that why you're leaving?
Yeah, exactly. Is that why you're leaving? Out? You feel comfortable? Well,
you feel like you peaked?
On top?
I don't. I mean, we talked about it earlier. I think the U.S. women can go to this coming Olympic Games with an expectation of all three being with a shot at a medal. Now, that doesn't mean what happens on the day can happen, right? But I think if you are a woman in this country and you wish to go to the Olympic Games, you need to be aiming for a medal because you won't be able to make the U.S. team without it because a maximum of three per gender. Men is a little different, but still, I think we've got a very competitive team and a competitive group in the U.S., albeit smaller than the women, to go to the game. So no, I think we'll send a full team to Paris and I think they'll do very well. I think they could potentially exceed our medal count from Tokyo. But it's, do I think that the US women has peaked? I think is a categoric no, because, well, we just talked about that for 10 minutes and ain't stopping here.
What? For another candidate looking for, so now obviously USA Weightlifting is going to need a new CEO, someone else in charge. And I believe you're going to, so your last day is in July, is that correct?
Right off the Nationals, July 15th. So I'll be at Masters Nationals and then Nationals.
So you're a big part of your role until then is assisting with hiring a new CEO. Is that correct as well?
That's the board's choice, not mine, but I'm fortunate enough they've asked me for some input, and you're right, I will be helping them with you know, guide them in what I see as some of the pitfalls and some of the attributes you need in a CEO.
What are a few of the things that you're looking for, or a few things that you are, you know, not looking for, I guess?
So at the moment, we're a little too soon to say that. I think that for me, my initial preference is for that person to be internal. I think we have a phenomenal team of staff at USA Weightlifting that I'm very proud of, and I hope that one of them can step up. However, what really has to happen is the board, and to a degree the community, has to decide what, not who, they want in the next CEO. That means asking questions like, what are our really serious challenges right now? What we really like about Phil that we didn't really talk about, or that we did, what do we not like so much? And those things, I'm a human being. Thank you for everybody who's saying this was great. But there's also attributes I'm not good at. I'm not good at steady on the rails. I'm good at innovation. I'm good at changing things. That's where I've got strengths. Do you need that now? I argue you probably don't. And so, you know, where does the group see that they need? What do you need in your next leader? What do you need fundraising experience? Do you need someone who's great with events? Do you need someone who's great on the performance side? What is it that you need from your next CEO of USA Weightlifting? And that's the most important question that the board and our stakeholders can ask itself right now before we get to the subject of who do we want? Because ultimately, you've got to look at, all right, we need these 10 things. Now we're looking for somebody who closely matches those, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 of those things that the organization says it wants. And that's where we get to it. I obviously can help to guide where I think what attributes you need to be a CEO of USA Weightlifting. But that's my main role, is to advise as opposed to drive.
So just recently, I think it was a month ago or so, Sean Waxman rather publicly stepped away from the board, right? Is that, you know, his kind of decisions or actions or whatever? Obviously, you have no control. I'm not asking you to really look inside his mind. You know, like his kind of complaints and his situation, you know, like kind of him stepping away and then the change here with your role. Are those related or completely separate instances? And, you know,
I don't think so. I mean, I think you need to talk to Sean for his own reasoning and his own thoughts. Absolutely.
Or just go check out his Instagram. Reasoning and insights there.
But, you know, I think for me, no. I think for me, it's just time to move on. It's time to give the baton to somebody else. It's time, you know, as a candidate, well, I'm tired after the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think this organization deserves a CEO that's got the energy that I did in 2019.
Yeah, that's good. I like that approach. I like that mindset of the Barry Sanders mindset, you know, kind of just going out on top.
Yeah, I mean, the role.
And like you said, you're aware that you're tired and, you're aware of, you know, that's good. The self-awareness, I think, is very important. I think that sometimes that doesn't happen, and then it can be negative effects on a business or on a organization. And
well, it requires sale. The job requires quite a bit of travel, and not travel just like one state to another, but we're talking time zones, different countries around the world, you know, a couple different times a year. So I can see how that would definitely add up.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and we obviously the world's going through the great resignation right now, which I guess I've just joined, but the,
you're part of the crew.
Yeah, right. I've got my crew, but there is some reflections on life that I think is brought about by COVID for us all. And you're right. You know, do I want to do that level of travel that I was doing? Not CEO does quite as much, but there is definitely travel required of CEOs in the Olympic movement and Paralympic movement. I will likely be a CEO in a different context of probably an Olympic or Paralympic organization. So there'll be some travel, and I don't mind that. But you know, I think for all of us, and I've heard this from coaches too, of you know, there's been a reflection on the amount that we want to spend away from our families and our friends at home. And I certainly would put myself in with that, if I'm fair. It's not, you know, I think, again, it's not the whole reason that I'm departing the organization, but you know, there's a part of that in there too, of how has COVID changed life for me, for the organization? How has COVID affected the organization? How has COVID affected me? There's elements of that in there for sure.
Well, you said like you're an innovator and you like challenges and changing things. Do you think part of it personally is that you've gotten it to a place you're happy with and you've kind of overcome that challenge and you're ready for another one?
Yes, in a sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I mean, in 2019, I actually sat down with our board and said I would likely look around after the Olympic Games for that exact reason.
Yeah.
That, you know, what I didn't know was we'd have the ARD Ion crisis come through the IWF and COVID. You know, I sat there in the end of August of 2019 thinking everything would be, you know, happy as day until the following year. it turned out to be very different than I had imagined. But, you know, this is, I guess, the coming to fruition of that original discussion in August of 2019. And what I actually said at the time was, I don't know that I'm the right person anymore for this organization because we've done a lot of change, we've done a lot of innovation, we've done a lot of making USA Weightlifting what it is today. Do we need that anymore? Or do we need somebody who's going to go, all right, slow your roll a little bit. Let's keep the train on the track. Let's keep us moving along in a nice, steady way. And I say that and it sounds almost disrespectful, but it's not. That's actually a very key skill that I don't have, but another leader probably does.
Well, I've heard from a lot of people that kind of do the same thing you do with that same approach. Is like they know their set of skills is to get someone from a not great spot to a good spot, but then that's where their skill set lies. Now, it's a different set, like you just said, it's a different set of skills for someone to that's more of a maintain and steady growth or small growth kind of thing, where you're like, I know how to make big changes quickly, as I think 10 years is not a very long time for something that's this old and this, you know, grand. That's a quick change, right? And I think from what I'm understanding is like you kind of specialize personally in kind of taking things from, you know, kind of bottom barrel grassroots kind of thing to where they are now. Does that sound
fair? And what we need now is somebody to polish that.
Yeah,
you know, and that's exactly you know, and that's exactly right. And a lot of that change happened even quicker. That, you know, really only became CEO in very late 2015. So that's really, you know, between then and now is when the
good point
happened. So that's a really quick amount of change in a really short time period. And you know, when I originally started doing that, it was with a mindset of 2024, not 2020. In terms of Olympic quads, and it happened much faster than we expected. So I think, you know, that's a really great way of putting it, and somebody who can come along and put that polish on it, and perhaps finesse might be the right terminology, is what would be great to see right now.
What is kind of, you know, I know we've held you here a while and you're kind of trying to get out a little bit earlier. What is the one thing they're most proud of over your tenure with USA Weightlifting? if you're to say, well, this is something I can, you know, hang my hat on, or makes me smile when I think about it.
You know, I've been asked that a couple of times over the last few weeks since I made this original decision. And I think I've settled on the answer of the American Open Series.
Dang, that's awesome.
Which is probably surprising to people. Mm-hmm. But I really love the concept of the American Open Series as somewhere, there's really two or three things behind it. One, it's a community festival style event of weightlifting.
I couldn't agree more.
The second thing I love about it is that it provides a stepping stone for everybody, whatever age you are. That, you know, one of the key things as we got better, you couldn't walk into the gym and have the American Open, as it was there now, the American Open Finals, on the wall of the gym, and it was achievable. It just wasn't for somebody at a decent amount of talent to do in 3 to 6 months. Now you walk into a gym, there's something on the wall that you can actually achieve by going to a local meet within half a year, if you're willing to be committed to it. And you know, the other thing I like is that you can compete. It's somebody likened it to the US Open in golf, which is not a comparison I thought of, but you can, in theory, compete against the Tiger Woods or the Phil Nicholson of the world, because you can show up, and if you happen to weigh in the right body weight category, you're competing against Kate Nye, Meredith Alwine, and Olivia Reeves. You might be in the session two or three below that, but that's actually a really cool thing, that you can be a 70-year-old woman weighing 71 kilograms and you can go and compete against Kate Nye.
Well, it encourages new athletes, right? Like if, you yeah. know, say you go and you do some local meets, but if you're looking and say, oh man, like it's just that next step seems so far away compared to, you know, you go and you qualify for the American Open Series and you go and you get the experience of lifting at a national meet. That's the motivation a lot of people might need to stick with the sport long enough to get that total that'll get them in a session at nationals.
Yeah. It's the connectivity. And that's exactly it. And it's, you know, and the American Open Series is probably the one of, if not the best thing that I did across that whole time, was coming up with that concept and implementing it. It's my favorite meet to the American Open Series. I just love what they are. And I have to say this, their events are, of course, not profitable from a strictly cost revenue standpoint.
Yeah.
I believe that there's a lot that goes into those meets. A lot of bodies, a lot of equipment.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are huge meets.
Yeah, there's a meme about that all the time, about that phrase. I have no idea where I actually said that first, but it's repeated to me all the time.
Well, awesome.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, Phil, I personally, you know, we've known each other a long time since when you were first kind of working with USA Weightlifting back in 2013 or 14. And anyway, I really appreciate you. You've always been real open, easy to talk to. Friendly. You've walked across the room when you've seen me there to say hi multiple times. Anyway, I really appreciate that. Appreciate everything you've done for the sport. And so
thanks, guys.
Like I said, seriously, if you ever need anything or have any whatever question, any way we can help, like don't be a stranger. Don't be afraid to reach out.
Likewise, and you know, for everybody, keep lifting and remember it can be done. I mean, those are the two things, right? It's the same thing the whole time. And it's been a wild ride for a decade, and one I will never forget for the rest of my life. And if I can, just spend a second just saying thank you to everybody in this community for allowing me the distinct pleasure of leading it for so long. It's been amazing. It's been a family. It's been a true journey. And I am both excited for the future, but sad to be saying goodbye.
Well, we thank you as well, Phil. You've been instrumental in the growth of USAW, our Olympic team, and someone who's been very diligent in cleaning up the doping. So thank you, and thanks for coming on.
Thanks, guys.
Last question real quick before we go. Sure. Last thing, because we put this off. We had something really important we were going to do today that we you know, knowing with the new news coming out, you know, I said, hey, let's get you on and talk to it, give you a chance to kind of, you know, talk to everyone, tell them kind of what's going on with the change and that type of stuff. And we'll try and get this out too within the next day or two, so it's still fresh for everybody.
Today. Yeah.
But last thing before you go, we got to know, if you're buying lotto tickets and you're going to buy scratchers, are you going to buy, you got $20 to spend, are you going to buy 10 $2 scratchers, 4 $5 scratchers, or one $20 scratcher? What do you think gives you the best odds of winning? Because we all have different opinions here, and we bought some. We're going to scratch them live today. but we put that off for you. Shows how important you are. But I want to know your take on it.
Well, look, if the pure goal is to win, I'd rather have more shots on goal. So it's I'd go for the 10 $2 scratches.
All right, there we go. We'll see next week.
Next week we'll find out.
Next week we'll find out.
What he didn't ask me was how much I needed to win. So I would go pure shots on goal, pure amounts of chances. It's I come from hockey, right? You got 20 shots, you're more like to score than you have two. So it's
the way that it was phrased, that's a fair answer. Yeah, that's a qualified answer.
Sounds good. All right, thanks again, Phil. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Phil.
Appreciate your time.
Yes, guys. Thanks for everything.
Thank you.
See you.
Bye bye.
All right, there you go.